Mr. George Keane, Reel 9. Mm. Now, we were talking about, well, we're getting towards the end of the war in the East, well, everywhere, you know.
Yes,
what any other things you remember just before the war comes to a close out there?
No. The operations that the Redoubt took part in while I was on her, we didn't have anything very outstanding. I know that we escorted some army landing craft to the Nicobar Islands to do a landing and deal with the Japanese on there, and it was a very well organised, precise operation in the way it was carried out, but there wasn't a single Japanese left on the island.
They'd all gone.
Yeah. One thing that was rather drastic in our operations out there was the time in which, the length of time we would stay on an operation, sometimes as long as a fortnight. And our ships were very backward in the layouts as regards storage of fresh food. For example, in the chief and petty officer's mess, all we had was an ice box, and I was the caterer, arranged the catering for the mess. And before we sailed in from Trincomalee, I used to be at my wit's end trying to find some fresh food, like onions and tomatoes and that, that would last long enough to we completed that particular voyage. And most of the time it was a case of corned beef. In fact, and I gave them beans that often that one evening when I went down for my supper in the chief and petty officer's mess, they'd all made themselves lariats and were whizzing them around and singing cowboy songs. They told me that I fed them on cowboy food long enough, they might as well be cowboys. However, the operations were fairly mild, and of course the day came when it was announced that the Japanese had surrendered.
Now, how did you react to sort of the news of the nuclear, the atomic bomb and the surrender of the Japanese?
Oh, we were over the moon. I mean, we couldn't care tuppence about the Japanese, when we saw them being eaten by the sharks, there was a lot of cheering going on. When the surrender was announced, we went into Penang. And we'd got a couple of chaps who'd been agents. We had a couple of fellas brought on board who'd been our agents and covert spying, etc., and had been caught by the Japanese, and they were not a pretty sight. They were like living skeletons. And the only thing I can remember otherwise about Penang was the fact that there was a rumour going round that if we could get ashore with a loaf of bread, we could buy a Chinese girl. We arrived back at the completion of all operations, we arrived back in Trincomalee, and I, with some others, was sent up into the hills amongst the teapam plantations, where it was cold enough to have frost on the ground at night time, for a week's rest.
What was that local leave like?
That was a local leave. That was the only leave I'd got for a couple of years there. During the war, my actual leave amounted to a month. That's all. I had 5 months in the United Kingdom. That's all. And I'll come to another point now. Okay, forget how long we'd been in Trincomalee Harbour, and when I went down with the signals to the captain one day, he told me that we were sailing for the United Kingdom the following day, but unfortunately I wasn't coming with them. There was a chief yeoman ashore in the commander-in-chief's headquarters, and apparently he was being sent home, and because I was a regular, I was being sent to relieve him. One good aspect of this was that in the ship's office was a supply of tickets for the beer ration then in force in Trincomalee, which amounted to 2 bottles per week. And the first lieutenant had these tickets stamped with the ship's stamp for weeks ahead and gave them all to me. And
did it work?
Well, I had friends for a couple of weeks anyway.
Now, what? So you were the signaller for who? The CNC, the naval commander?
No, I'll tell you now. And the chiefs and petty officers' accommodation ashore was in a building that had been built by Italian prisoners of war. It had 3 sides and faced onto one of the lagoons. And the finish of the floors and that was absolutely beautiful. The Italians, as you know, are experts in this kind of thing. And I then started my... I've been there for a couple of days when I went down at the communication headquarters to start my job, which was one most of the sailors in the fleet would have viewed with envy. The shift in which I had charge was 24 ends. 24 ends. And during my period of time there, I learnt a lot about human nature. I didn't leave to come home until the winter of 1947.
So you were there from 45 to 47?
Yeah.
And it was a communications headquarter?
Yes.
And what was the shore station called there?
HMS High Flyer.
It was HMS High Flyer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how did you get on with these wrens?
Very well. I got on with the wrens very well. But you see, at that time, the wrens were a separate entity on their own. They were not under naval discipline. And except for giving one of them a good telling off at any time, anything worse than that, I had to go through the chief officer wrens, who was a very nice lady, the ex-headmistress of a very prominent London school, and who I got on with very well. But on one occasion, up on the side of one of the mountains overlooking the harbour, we had a signal station. It was so high up, it could communicate with ships about 30 miles out at sea by lamp. And half a dozen signalmen up there, and they rang me up one day when they knew what my job was, and they asked if they could scrounge some food and that and get it together to make a bit of a party one night, could I organise some wrens to come up and join them? And this I did. And in the meantime, I had a driving course. I was very pally with the chief petty officer who ran the naval driving school there, because it was such a huge organisation. And I asked him one day, what about me learning to drive? So we were at a bit of a wangle. He put me down as a possible coxswain for the Admiral. And I did my training on a 12-ton army truck. And then I had to do a test, and that was on a 400 weight Chev truck straight from Canada with all the gears packed with thick grease and the other way round. And I did my test driving amongst bullet carts and all kinds of things. Then to come back to my story of this, so I arranged with half a dozen wrens to go up with these lads, and I went to the pool and borrowed a truck to take them in. And I took them up this mountain, and we had quite a good evening. It was quite pleasant, you know, a few drinks and a bit of music and tales with the lads and whatnot. And I think it was about 11 o'clock at night when I started back. Coming back through the dockyard, the truck broke down. Well, of course, at that time, I didn't know a great deal about the engine side of us, and it took me a while to get it started. And, of course, the girls were all late getting back. Well, the next morning, I got a note. Will I please go and see the first officer, Renz? So I went to see her, and she said, why was it my girls were so late getting back last night? So I explained it to her, and I felt such a damn fool, because she said, do you know, it's absolutely marvellous. These trucks never break down going, only when they're coming back. And she didn't believe for one minute that I was genuine, but I was. One recollection I have at one Christmas there, of course, we managed to do quite well for food and drink for occasions like Christmas, if you knew where to go for it, you know, and I did know where to go for it. And we'd had a real good do, and one of our members had bought a dugout canoe, and he cut a hole in the middle of this canoe and lowered an outboard motor through the middle of it, you see. And after lunch on this particular Christmas day, we decided to take some drinks and some food down to the girls who were on duty in the communications headquarters, you see. Well, we'd all had a few drinks, and we bundled ourselves into this canoe, and as we turned the corner into the main harbour towards the steps of the quay to go up into communications headquarters, the surface of the harbour was a bit loppy and slopped into the canoe, and unfortunately it sank, and we were all left swimming. Well, I wasn't too bad. I had a shirt and white trousers on, so when we, of course, the sun was very hot, and you soon dried out. But one of our number, whose name I will not mention, he stripped off, and we walked in the communication headquarters with him stark naked carrying his clothes. And some of the Wrens couldn't stop laughing, others didn't know where to put themselves. And the next day, he had to go in the canteen and buy a pad and write a letter of apology to each Wren individually.
Anything? It sounds like good luck. Now, HMS Flyer, that's at Trincomalee, is it? Or is that at...
Yes, I've got the wrong name for Colombo. What was the name of Colombo now? I think Colombo came under another name.
I've forgotten what it is, but I'll make a note of that.
Yeah, I think...
So HMS High Flyer, that's Trincomalee Shore Station, yeah. Anything else happened while you were there? It sounds quite a pleasant life, those 2 years.
It was. You can make say that it was a very pleasant life, but after a couple of months, I found it very, very difficult to settle down, because after so many years of excitement and extra responsibility, and all of a sudden, everything seemed dead. You were in a routine. You could go get regular sleep, regular food, and I think you'll find a lot of servicemen found it difficult. I know after I came out of the Navy in 1950, and I came into the police force.
Hang on, we will come to that when we come to it. So, but you were already starting to find that you know, your wartime experiences were affecting you, even, you know, in peacetime in the Navy.
Yes, to that extent, that it was very, very difficult to settle down to a routine life, easy routine life.
Now, what happened next? So you were there till nothing much happened until 47, I
when I came home. Now, I was given a lift on one of the aircraft carriers going home from the Far East.
And that was 47?
As a passenger, yeah.
And what were your final postings? You know, just...
I went to my barracks at Chatham. And of course, seagoing billets then were becoming rare. And I was, to give me a job, I was put in charge of the signal station at Bull's Head Locks, which are the entrance to Chatham Dockyard. It was the most monotonous job I ever had, because we only had two or three ships coming in and out during the course of a week. And I worked fortunately I worked 2 days on, 2 days off, and went to live with friends at Southend.
So that's Bull's Head Locks, Chatham Dockyard, and you were there 47 till, how long were you there? Or was it 48 by the time you got there?
Till beginning of 49. Beginning of 49.
So about a year.
About a year, yes. Altogether. I did some time at the Dockyard Tower as well, but that doesn't matter. It was in the same, it was same kind of job. Until I went into the barracks for a lunch one day, and I met the chief petty officer who had been our coxswain on the Hotspur. He told me that the last captain we had had on the Hotspur was commissioning a brand new destroyer, HMS Crossbow, down at the builder's yard in Southampton, and that if he saw me, he was to ask me, would I like to go with him? So I very quickly made my way to the drafting master at arms office and found out there was nobody detailed for the crossbow, and the following day I was on my way down to join her as a yeoman of signals.
Now, what do you remember of your time on her? You're just on her a year, I presume, if you left in 50.
Yeah, that's right. We went a couple of months after commissioning. We were sent with one other of our flotilla to Key West in Florida to work with the American Navy, because we had the latest thing, the latest equipment for detecting submarines, and they had built the first streamlined submarine. And we went to work together to see what we could do and what they could do, you see. And Key West was a very pleasant place to be, very hot, but at that particular time that we were there, we were very restricted for dollars. So we could not have quite as big, as nice a time there as we had anticipated. And whilst there, we did have one tragedy. Owing to the heat, we had awnings spread over the bridge. And one afternoon, we were working with the submarine when it was submerged, and the way in which we communicated with it while it was submerged was by the use of hand grenades. One would be thrown over the side and the submarine would feel the bang, and one would mean something too for something else, etc., etc. And working with us was an American blimp, you know, the small airships. And this particular afternoon, I'd been down to my mess, and one of my young signalmen called Peters was on the signalman on the bridge, because the other destroyer wasn't with us at the time. I was still in harbour. We're on our own. There's nothing much doing. I'd been down the mess, and about 3 o'clock I decided to go up and have a look and see what was going on. As I walked up the ladder at the back of the bridge, so the seaman gunner of the watch, who was at the back of the bridge with his box of hand grenades, was told by the captain to fling one hand grenade over the side. This he did, but unfortunately, there was a wireless aerial coming down from the yardarm to the bridge, and instead of going clean, the hand grenade hit the wireless aerial and bounced back into the corner of the awning on the bridge. As I stepped, it landed in the corner of the awning just as I stepped off the back ladder onto the bridge, and my young Sigmund rushed forward to punch it out with both his hands when it exploded. He had both his arms blown off and a chest full and face full of shrapnel, and the gunnery officer standing next to me was shredded. The captain had shrapnel in his ribs, and the other person on the bridge was also injured, and I didn't get a scratch. So I came to the conclusion that throughout my life in the Navy, somebody upstairs had been looking after me.
So, I mean, the two of them dead, or was the one with the no upper...
One was killed, the gunner was killed, and my young signalman was very, very badly injured. We had a wireless set on the bridge with which we talked to the blimp, and I called him up straight away and told him we'd had an explosion on the bridge and injured. And within 20 minutes, the Americans had a torpedo boat on our way to us with doctors and nurses on board. And it was the Americans who organised the funeral for the gunner and also flew his family out from United Kingdom.
Now, do you remember anything about the anti-submarine trials? I mean, or they're not your thing, really?
Well, the trials were, as far as I know, they were successful. One other episode that happened while we were there was we were warned by the Americans not to tangle with the police in Key West. And one of our lads was ashore one evening, and his story was that because he had no wristwatch on, he went to this car and had a look through the side window to see if there was a clock on the dashboard. And a policeman about 300 or 400 yards down the street shot him without even speaking to him. And the bullet entered his back, missed all his vital organs, and was on the front of his skin of his stomach when they took him to Naval Hospital. We said, what's going to happen if he dies? They said, oh, nothing much.
So, I mean, did that not cause a bit of unrest amongst the crew against the police, or did they just accept?
Well,
it?
The only other episode that happened, they did shoot a lad from the other destroyer. I did hear he'd staggered up somebody's driveway, and the bloke never even opened his door. He shot him through the door, which he was quite entitled to do, but I say I only heard about that.
What was life? Did you get ashore much?
Oh, yes.
A typical visit, a trip ashore like?
Typical visit ashore. Well, as I previously mentioned, we were very restricted with dollars, but I was absolutely amazed at the friendliness of the Americans who would say to us, well, look, if you want to take my car and drive to Miami tonight, which was 250 miles, here's the key. But, of course, we were in no position to do that because of shortage of money. And anyway, as Britishers, we were not conversant with the attitude which allowed you to drive 250 miles for a night out.
And what would you do ashore? Would you go to the bars? Was it a friendly place?
Marvellous open air cinemas, and things like a pint of ice cream were dirt cheap. In fact, the food, we hadn't seen food like they had for years. Very impressed.
So the Americans generally friendly then?
Oh, yes.
With the exception of the policemen.
Very much so. Very much so, yeah. Very much so.
Now, anything else about this period at Key West?
No, it was just, except for what I've already described, it was more or less routine. And as far as I can remember, the trials were quite successful, and eventually we came back home, and I had one more trip in her to Hull. We went to Hull for a week or so, And after that, I left to go into barracks to finish my time in the Navy.
So when were you demobilised?
At the...
That was 1950?
Yes, end of July 1950. I joined...
Had you thought of staying in the Navy? Because that was your 12 years, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, yes.
Why didn't you stay in? Because you'd enjoyed it, really.
I was... I must have... I know we forget all the bad things, we always remember the good things, but I did enjoy my time in the Navy. It was the finest thing I ever did, joining the Navy, because I did very well for myself.
So why did you leave? Why didn't you stay?
I knew what, if I signed on for another, at that time you could sign on for another 10 years, but you had to come out at 40. And the signal received in the crossbow was to the effect that I was recommended to sign on, and if I did so, I was going to be sent straight down to Portsmouth for a course which would have given me the top. It's difficult to describe this to you, I think.
Promotion.
I was going to be promoted to chief in any case straight away. I was top of the roster in Chatham for quite a long time, because with the cessation of the war, it put immediate stop to most promotion for years. But I was going to be sent on a course down to Portsmouth get to the highest
qualification. It doesn't matter.
The highest qualification I could as a rating. But as at that particular time, as a contrast to what happens today, I would have had to leave the Navy at the age of 40, and I thought the best thing for me to do was to come out on my 30th birthday, because I stood a fair chance of obtaining some form of work with a reasonable chance of being taken on.
Now, did they give you any retraining or anything at all, or advice when you left the Navy? Because you'd been in there since you were a lad.
That's right.
I mean, was there anything that they did you to prepare you for the outside world?
Well, the only thing that we were offered was for the 2 or 3 weeks that we were in the barracks, I was in the barracks, you could go and have a vocational training on learning to put wallpaper up or something like that.
Now, did you take advantage of any of that?
Oh, yes, it was a bit of a doddle, but I did some woodwork. Still got some of the wood, teak I brought with me out in my garage, actually, all those years ago.
But that was it, a bit of woodwork training.
That was it, yes.
Any advice on careers or what to do or anything like that?
Well, the only advice I would give anybody today...
No. Did you get any?
No advice at all. I didn't get any advice at all on anything. There wasn't organisations recruiting ex-servicemen like there are today. I mean, the Navy News today is full of adverts for men with skills acquired during the Navy.